I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The city of Philadelphia wins a $3.5 million grant to fund a plan to cut its overcrowded jail population by more than one-third over the next 3 years. Details from WHYY's Katie Colinari.
Right now, roughly 7,000 people are sitting in Philadelphia's jails, more than those jails were built to hold. About 60% of them are simply waiting for trial. The grant, awarded by the MacArthur Foundation, would help fund a sweeping set of reforms. Deputy District Attorney George Mosey says they'll help put fewer nonviolent people behind bars for shorter periods of time.
This is something that we're very committed to because we want to do all that we can to ensure that we employ our limited resources to target the offenders that pose the greatest public safety threat to our community.
The total reform package will cost $6 million, with $2 million coming from the city and the rest to be raised from private donors. The biggest share of the money will be spent on expanding alternatives to cash bail. That means more things like electronic monitoring and day reporting centers for people who are released from jail while they wait their day in court. The city also wants to beef up diversion programs for those charged with selling drugs like heroin. Public defender Tom Innes says the plan marks a shift in how Philadelphia looks at its criminal justice system.
We've been focusing on reentry, people coming out of jail. What we need to do is those folks who are on their first arrest, their first contact, is to get them the services that they might not get till they were getting out of jail.
The plan also wants to deal with persistent racial disparities by providing training to root out bias across the system. About 70% of inmates in Philadelphia are people of color. Katie Colinari, WHYY News.
As the Pennsylvania primary approaches, the two Democratic presidential candidates are making direct appeals to African-American voters. Bernie Sanders is working to introduce himself. Hillary Clinton seeks to consolidate and strengthen long-standing ties to the community. WHYY's Dave Davies reports.
This week, the Clinton campaign began running a new TV ad in Philadelphia and markets throughout Pennsylvania, featuring a familiar and respected voice.
She says their names.
Trayvon Martin. Shot to death. Don Trey Hamilton. Unarmed.
Sandra Bland.
Did nothing wrong.
And makes their mother's fight for justice her own.
Yes, that's Morgan Freeman, with a voice so authoritative he's been cast as God on film. He finishes the ad by saying, "She always stood with us." Democratic strategist Mark Nevin says Bill Clinton was beloved in the state's African-American community in the 90s, and that extended to Hillary when she pursued her own ambitions.
Even in 2008, running against Barack Obama, she had the endorsement of African-American leaders in the state.
Black voters' affection for Clinton is reflected in a Franklin and Marshall poll that found Clinton leading Sanders by 51 percentage points. But Sanders is determined to compete. When he visited Philadelphia for a mass rally at Temple last week, his campaign added a second event for the afternoon.
Senator Sanders, we want to welcome you to Philadelphia. I'm going to welcome you to Tunney Temple.
Sanders met with a mostly African-American crowd at the historic Tendley Temple United Methodist Church in South Philadelphia, and he made a point to address concerns of black voters, including police brutality, education, and jobs.
51% unemployed or underemployed. We should be investing in those kids in jobs and education, not jails and incarceration.
It wasn't a huge crowd, and Sanders is not getting much public support from black elected leaders here, but his campaign has a TV ad produced by Spike Lee.
People of color have a deeply vested interest in what Bernie Sanders brings to us in this election.
That's actor and civil rights activist Harry Belafonte, who hands off to the daughter of Eric Garner, who died after New York police officers put him in a chokehold. Garner's words, "I can't breathe," as caught on video, became a rallying cry for protests against police brutality. The Clinton campaign is responding with a new radio ad on gun violence, which says her Democratic opponent has voted repeatedly against background checks. The Pennsylvania primary is a week from Tuesday. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
At this hour, a gathering is underway in Philadelphia to discuss another voting block in the city that could also be a factor in Pennsylvania's upcoming primary. Aldea's executive editor, Sabrina Vorvulius, will be one of the moderators of the Latino Vote Town Hall meeting. It's sponsored by the Spanish-language newspaper. She says the goal is for Latinos to paint their own picture of what it means to be a Latino voter and to not let others do it.
It's almost inevitably spoken about from the outside in. You know, we have articles in The New Yorker, we have articles all over the place that reflect a view from the outside of the Latino community. And that's why we decided that we really needed to talk about the Latino vote with Latino politicians and people who are involved with the Latino electorate from the inside, looking out.
Vorvulia says this inside perspective is important to overcome the generalizations and stereotypes that politicians often apply to Latinos.
I don't think that any of the campaigns, Republican or Democratic, has a good sense of who the Latino voter is nationally, and an even worse sense of who the Latino voter is in the Northeast and in Philadelphia specifically. But mostly I see campaigns that speak about Latinos in broad generalities and don't seem to understand how complicated and rich Latino communities really are.
Aldea will hold two additional Latino vote town hall meetings, one prior to the Democratic National Convention to be held in Philadelphia in July, and one prior to November's election. Sunshine, temperatures approaching 70 degrees in the weekend forecast, and for many, thoughts turn to the summer season. Let's feel the sea breeze with Justin Osiello, Down the Shore blogger for Newsworks.org. Hey, Justin.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. And I'm wondering if I'm speaking to you from Ocean City, because that town was named the best beach in America.
Yeah, actually, I am just up the coast in South Seaside Park, but you're right. Ocean City was just named best beach in the entire United States by Coastal Living magazine. They went through this NCAA basketball style bracket tournament, and they were in the finals with Huntington Beach in California. Ocean City beat out beaches from coast to coast, including Alaska and Hawaii. So it is quite an honor, and congratulations, Ocean City. We're very, very happy for you.
Now, we won't look too closely at the voting methodology that produced that result, but it does add to its list of accomplishments, cited as America's greatest family resort.
That was one of the accomplishments, and as I'm sure many of the listeners are aware, the magazine also cited that Ocean City is a dry town, and I'm sure that has a lot to do with Ocean City being dubbed the greatest family resort in the United States.
Let's talk about preparations for the summer season and move up a notch to Margate, where there was just a ruling about dunes and replenishment.
Yes, there was just a ruling this week in State Superior Court, and the judge ruled that the state can move forward with beach replenishment. At issue in that case, and in also cases throughout the Jersey Shore, there were some private property owners who still have not signed easements that would allow for beach replenishment and dune creation. In that particular case, the municipality and some residents said that the bulkhead, which extends along the oceanfront in Margate, was and is sufficient to protect the community. The judge held that the state is right, that the beach replenishment serves a public purpose, and the public purpose is protecting life and property in the community. So Governor Christie, back in 2013, famously called out the oceanfront property owners who have refused to sign easements to allow this work as being greedy and selfish. So it looks like this is a victory for the governor. And I can just tell you from the commenting that I've seen in my news articles and also other news articles, the vast majority of people and the public who live in these communities are quite happy.
And so with that, is this battle over eminent rights still playing out in other shorefront communities, or is it substantially solved?
No, it's not solved, and you know, these two cases were held in Superior Court, so it can certainly be appealed.
For tourists and visitors coming to the Jersey Shore in the 2016 season, will there be much, if any, evidence still remaining from Superstorm Sandy?
As a tourist, if you're coming down to the Jersey Shore this summer, if you're coming across from Philadelphia, there's still plenty to do. The boardwalks will all be up and running, with the exception, of course, in a section of the seasides and Seaside Park specifically. There was a massive fire in 2013, and that pier has not been rebuilt. But in, you know, Ocean City, Wildwoods, especially in the southern areas that did not really take a major hit from Sandy, I think this summer may actually shape up to be a banner year. I just spoke with a business owner in Seaside Park, and from what he was telling me is that realtors in Ocean County have been saying that their rentals are way up. And I've spoken with realtors all up and down the coast in recent weeks, and they're all echoing the same thing. Summer rentals are up. They're very optimistic. And, you know, it's been a struggle in the last few years. But there's always that one wild card, Dave. It's weather. Having adverse weather on a bunch of weekends can be devastating for local business owners that rely on day trippers. But I think another important thing, Dave, summer gas prices are projected to be at their lowest levels since 2004. And that's according to a report in Bloomberg today. All in all, if the weather holds out, Dave, I think we're going to have a great summer.
A lot of pieces potentially in place. Justin, great speaking with you again on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave. It's a pleasure, as always.
Justin Osiello, Down the Shore blogger for Newsworks.org. Still ahead this evening, crafting a great violin requires being less sentimental and more scientific.
A big part of my work, and something that takes a little doing, is to get people to really be frank about how they feel with an instrument.
Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. This week, musicians and instrument makers will gather at the Kimmel Center to talk about the science of stringed instruments. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports on the difference between a good violin and a great violin.
This is the sound of an original Stradivarius. It was made over 320 years ago. It's a very good violin. Stradivarius violins are considered the finest ever made, handed down from player to player for centuries. This one is now in the hands of concert soloist Vadim Gluzman, a Russian-Israeli musician who's played everywhere from Philadelphia to London to Munich.
I do think that this thing is alive, and it has a soul, and we leave imprints. Those that play it, we leave our stamps.
Tchaikovsky wrote his violin concerto for this very violin. Its history is part of the way we appreciate its music, but sentimentality can get in the way of science.
I mean, I actually sort of encourage people to be a little less emotional.
This is Samuel Zygmuntowicz. He's one of the world's most sought-after violin makers.
I want them to not react to the mystique of things. A big part of my work, and something that takes a little doing, is to get people to really be frank about how they feel with an instrument.
From his Brooklyn studio, Zygmuntowicz tailors violins and cellos for professionals. He makes on average about 8 instruments a year, some of them worth over $100,000. He can make you an exact copy of a Stradivarius, but he says that's not good enough.
The difference between a really great violin and a pretty good violin is very, very, very small. That little increment is hard won, and that's not something you get by copying. You have to do that working directly with the musician.
Zygmuntowicz does extensive research into exactly how an instrument behaves while it's being played. He collaborates with scientists and engineers to monitor violins with vibration scanning lasers, using that data to make 3-dimensional computer animations of exactly how the instrument warps and wobbles to get its unique musical tone. He presented some of this research as part of a series of talks called String Theory, during the Philadelphia International Festival of the Arts. He says a violin reacts to different players differently. Yumi Kendall is an assistant principal cellist for the Philadelphia Orchestra. She's also participating in the string theory talks. She was recently in the market for a new cello and decided on this one. It's a Vincenzo Pastiglione made in 1877.
I tried it in chamber music, in solo, and in orchestra. And in all of those contexts, it felt great. It's kind of like playing dark, melted chocolate.
Kendall says she is not interested in the instrument's pedigree. She was focused on how the instrument reacted to her.
The instrument for me is very much like a partner in crime. It brings out my good sides, hopefully. It also can understand my weaknesses, and likewise, I will do the same for it.
Kendall sees her instrument as a living, evolving thing. But does it actually have a soul? Probably not.
I have not yet named this cello as in a personal way. I only think of it as chocolate.
I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
The Theater of the Absurd is alive and well in Philadelphia. The Idiopathic Ridiculopathy Consortium has been presenting classic examples of 1950s absurdist theater for the past 10 years. At a recent event, they turned to a modern source, The Onion, the self-proclaimed America's finest news source. Here's a sample from that evening.
It seems that big government is always finding more ways to trample on the God-given rights of freedom-loving Americans like you and me. You know, right at this very moment, I bet they're finding whole new ways to stick their noses into everybody's business. Now, I can't tell you what they've got planned next, but I can tell you one thing. There'll be hell to pay if Uncle Sam or anybody else ever comes after my garbage. Seriously, I'd just like to see those government clowns try and take my trash away. That's one place where I absolutely draw the line. I'm not about to let the government come onto my property and take my garbage from my home, not without a fight. No, I will lay down my life before I let them get their hands on so much as a single one of my crumpled up napkins or discarded pizza boxes. You see, if you give them an inch, they'll take a mile. They're going to start by grabbing all the bags of trash you've got piled up by the curb, but it won't stop there. Next, they're going to come for your recycling. Paper and plastic, bottles and cans, whatever you like. Oh, have any raked up leaves or lawn clippings bagged up in your front yard? Get ready to kiss those goodbye, too. They're going to send men into your neighborhood to round up all the garbage and take it away forever. Anyone who tells you different is lying. It could be today. It could be tomorrow. It could be while you're at work or early in the morning while you're still in bed. It could be Monday between the hours of 7 and 9 a.m. Or if that happens to be a public holiday, it could be Tuesday. But make no mistake, they're coming. And once you let them get their hands on your trash, that's that. You're not getting it back. We should fear any government that doesn't want its citizens to have garbage. That's my firmly held belief. Maybe you're one of those people who thinks the authorities ought to take away the refuse of every last American citizen. Fine. You have a right to your own opinion. But a country where some ignorant government lackey can just take away the trash of anyone they want at a moment's notice is not the kind of country I want to live in. And if these people think they can get mine, I'd like to see them try anytime, day or night. I'll be standing right here on my doorstep with a fully loaded bag of garbage in each hand, ready to give them hell.
That's Jack Tambori with a dramatic reading from The Onion presented by the Idiopathic Ridiculopathy Consortium. They're launching a series of readings from absurdist literature with Edward Albee's 1960 play, The American Dream, on Saturday at L'Etage Cabaret. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional help today from Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.